your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
If you're an average person who isn't unduly technical, even with our record low unemployment, you may find it challenging to find a good, stable, ethical job that pays well, doesn't require a 90-minute commute each way. That can make self-employment tempting, although daunting. What are keys to maximizing your chances of making a good living as a self-employed person, a small business owner, even if you're not a data scientist with expertise in machine learning, deep learning, artificial intelligence, regarding the genome? With me to tackle that question is Mike Goldsby. He heads up the Entrepreneurship Center at Ball State University, and he created a course and delivered a course called the Entrepreneur's Toolkit, part of the prestigious Great Courses series. It's some of the best courses in the world that get picked out. Anyway, Mike Goldsby, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you, Marty. Good to be on your show.
Great. So let's say I'm not very technical, and I'm having a hard time landing a decent job. So I'm contemplating self-employment, and I don't have tons of money. It's not like I'm going to be able to open some fancy $2 million restaurant. What do I need to keep in mind before taking the plunge?
Well, I think there's a couple of things you want to do. I think the first thing is you want to consider what's called your affordable loss. So your affordable loss, you ought to be able to go into it with the idea that maybe you won't make it, and if it doesn't work, how much can you afford to lose? And so that kind of helps make the jump into business a little bit more doable and a little bit less stressful. And the second thing is to do your due diligence. I mean, really research what you're going into, really look into it. And also part of that due diligence is talking to other people who know you. Let them test the idea with you and maybe give you some things to consider.
Before you go to number three, tell me some more about what due diligence in the real world needs to look like. I understand what big corporations do for doing due diligence, but if I am this solo operator, what should my due diligence look like?
Yeah, good question. You know, one thing you want to do is you want to look at the people who are already doing what you're thinking about doing. There's a famous neuroscientist at Harvard, Daniel Gilbert. He wrote Stumbling on Happiness.
Right.
And, you know, his main lesson was before you do something big, look at how others are doing on that same thing, because chances are it might go very, very well the same way for you.
Now, that's very easy to do when you're talking about retail. If I want to open a burrito shop, I just go to the highest Yelp review burrito shops and look at their menu, look at their ergonomics, look at their pricing, look at everything they do. But most businesses are not so transparent, and the owner is not necessarily going to be so willing to share his or her deep, dark secrets. How do I find out what the other people are doing and how well they're doing? I'm not going to ask them to see their books.
Right. That's right. You know, there are other people who do see those books, maybe not on that particular business, but on businesses like it. So bankers, accountants, those are people who can give you general industry overviews and can also really give you they see so many different types of businesses, and they can give you some really good advice to think about. I have a very good friend who's one of my best friends is an accountant, and anytime I'm considering something, he's one of the first people I go to who can really say, you know, that's a pretty tough industry to get into. The margins are really slim. But then they can also tell you the ones that made it, and maybe you can go study those. You know, again, as a customer going by there, just trying to look at what makes that one stand out that you hear about as opposed to the others that might not be getting by so easily.
What I really like the idea of contacting bankers and accountants, because they do see the numbers in the books, and that's the information you're not going to be getting. And again, most businesses are not retail businesses where you can just walk in. That's a really good idea. I like it. Okay, you said that there were four steps that you need to take as you're deciding whether to do it. You've talked about two. What's number three and number four?
Yeah, number three is, start to take those steps of maybe, you know, some people really are not big fans of business plans, but I still think business plans have a place because it's a document that you can show people what your ideas are, and they can help point out where some of your gaps in thinking are. We know business plans will change over time, but it is something when you go to talk to your accountant friend or you talk to your banker that you can say, you know, here's what I'm thinking about. Am I missing anything? And then the fourth step.
Before we get to the fourth step. So, but
sure.
Business plans, I've seen everything from the three pages that basically says, what is my product? How is it differentiated from the competition? How am I going to get the money to start it? What kind of money? How much do I need? How am I going to market it? And what are my projections, knowing that they're fairly BS-y, but it's better to have some of them. And that's a two-page document. And yet I've seen others that are telephone books. How much of a business plan for the typical solo operator or 2-3 person business is necessary?
I would say 10 to 15 pages is enough.
What would go in there? What would go in 10 to 15 pages worth?
Yeah, 10 to 15 pages. The main parts in there are that you really understand the customer, that you really have an idea who you're targeting, right? So even if you're going into that burrito business, there might be a different a particular segment of the market that you're trying to reach.
Like
maybe
what?
Differently
what am I? Let's say I got a pager. You know, you got 15 pages, 10 or 15 pages. Let's say I want to devote two to my understanding my customer. People, everybody likes burritos. What am I going to write in these two pages?
Yeah, in these two pages, you're going to location is a big one, right? So you're going to make sure that you're going into a market where there's enough burrito enthusiasts, right? That you can get that going. And then you're also going to want to know that there's enough of a market there to warrant that. Who's in that market? The competition in that market, and then why you think your burrito business will fit in there. And you know, another aspect of that though, in getting that information on that, I'm a big fan of is visiting other places outside your market. So yeah, you want to put it in that one location. One of my students has a booming industry or booming company right now in kombucha tea here in Indiana,
right
in the Midwest, and he got the idea from Seattle. He was in Seattle and he was the first mover in Indianapolis, and now he's got a five-state region with kombucha all over the place.
But I want to say, you said that you're going to devote a couple of pages to knowing your customer. Let's forget about burritos for a minute.
Okay.
But let's say, it's a widget. Let's just take something generic. Let's say, I want to distribute kombucha tea, right? It's a big deal. So what do I need to, how am I going to, what information is worth putting in that business plan? How am I going to get it? It's not just, is this a good location? What really, if Mike Goldsby was devoting a page or two to this is my target customer and you were going to try to distribute kombucha tea to restaurants and, specialty boba tea places or whatever, what are you going to write in those two pages?
Well, in those two pages, I'm going to try to really emphasize why my kombucha tea or my product, my service is just outstanding, why I believe it is. And the second thing that's really got to come across in that is that I, Mike Goldsby, can deliver that to the customer, and there's a reason why Mike Goldsby is doing that. That's got to come across really clearly. Why me, and why can I do it really well?
I think what you're doing here is you're supporting my position on the three-pager, because you were already moving away from the customer, and right away in the beginning you're talking about what differentiates you in the marketplace. I want to get a sense, really, of what needs to fill 10 to 15 pages, because that's daunting to a lot of people, and because it seems to me, and I want you to, you're the entrepreneurship expert, but I'm not chopped liver. I think we reach quite quickly a point of diminishing returns when you get beyond the few pages. And so I need to hear the rationale for going to 10 to 15. Tell me about that.
Sure. The 10 to 15 is if you were going to go see your accountant or banker friend, because they're going to go a little bit deeper into the ideas behind this business.
And what are you going to put in it? I want to know what you're going to put in the 12 pager that you're not going to put in the 3.
Well, one of the key things is operations, right? I mean, what are the touch points that you're going to have in place? How are you going to be really good at those different points of delivering the product or service? Thinking that through, those like really good details into how am I going to deliver this? And I think that's a real separator for people is really trying to think about, okay, if I'm really going to do this, what's required for me to get it to the customer, to make sure the customer's happy, to deal with problems if there is any problem with the customer, how do I fix that? So I think it's the operations side of it that is a differentiator that probably won't come across in that two or three pager.
I like it. So it would be everything from supply chain. Where are you going to get the stuff to make sure it's not tainted and it's high quality? And what kind of estimates you have of pricing? How are you going to deal with shipping if indeed, the tea is being made in China? How are you going to deal with duties and tariffs, and how good are your estimates? Then how are you going to get it shipped to here, and what are your shipping costs going to be? How are you going to be, you know, your packaging costs? How are you going to go in by getting it distributed? How are you then going to deal with problems of complaints? How are you going to estimate freshness? Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. And then a step further, if there's any problems with any of those areas, what's your response? And, you know, some people call those critical risk. But I think it's just the general nature of what can happen in business that it's, somebody says, okay, so what if your main supplier goes on strike or there's a tariff or whatever? So now how do you get your product? I mean, being able to answer, having the operations laid out and then being able to address anything that could come up along that shows that you're prepared, that you've thought this through.
Makes good sense. You said, now we're on number four. You said there was one more key to, before you jump in, four things to prepare. What's number four?
Yeah, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, the failing fast, but I think just trying to make an early run on your product in a cheap way, just a little experiment, a little test, just to test it out to see if it's going to respond. I mean, you can do these in a very cheap way before you even set up the whole business, but just to get a little knowledge and to see if you're missing anything. And then sometimes there's those little things that can pop up that maybe, you know, those initial conditions might get you off to a better start.
So let's stay with the kombucha's fun because it really is very Bay Area-centric. It's very typical. I'm glad they've got them in Indiana, but it's certainly, you know, it's current. So what would be that, what I call a shoestring test? You know, doing it on a shoestring. What would be the shoestring test that Mike Goldsby would do if he was testing out his kombucha business?
Yeah, I can tell you what my student did.
Okay.
And he took my advice. I'm actually an advisor to him on this business.
Cool.
When he started out, he just made a canister. He made some canisters, and he was so proud of them. You know, he had a few canisters of different recipes for the kombucha, and he got a little time, a little space, one night at a coffee bar in a very popular part of Indianapolis, and he talked his way into trying to sell some of that there. Mm. It went over well, and then eventually he started making bigger batches for the same place until he got into a food incubator in a major part of Indianapolis eventually getting a full production of the kombucha. Now his biggest issue is he's trying to get trying to find that major investor to help him keep up with his demand.
Let's go there we'll go there in a minute. Let's not forget about that. Let's talk about getting investment. But I want to, because it's fun for me, actually, I'm going to try out what I would do as a shoestring if I were trying to create this kombucha business. I would have a party at my house so that I could run essentially a focus group testing. I can ask more questions. I would invite people from what I think are the target buyers of kombucha. It tends to be young people. It tends to be hip people. It probably disproportionately will be people of Asian descent, although certainly people of all races use it. But I would have a party with 10 to 20 people, and I would have probably two or three recipes of kombucha, and I would give them all a simple little questionnaire. Rate how much you like this from 1 to 10. What's the most you'd pay for a cup of this? What do you like and what do you not like about it? And please be brutally honest. And then an open-ended, is there anything else you want to tell me? I would have them write it so they were committed to it. And then I would have a little and I would quickly glance at the 10 peoples or whatever. And I would then ask follow-up questions based on what I read. That wouldn't cost me a dime, and I would be getting a pretty darn good market test. What do you like and not like about that approach?
I love that approach. I mean, I think that would be a great approach. Yeah, it's low cost, shoestring. You get your target market there, and you know that student I told you about actually kind of did that with our class. He brought it into class, and basically did the same thing.
Sure, that captive audience is great. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking with Mike Goldsby. He runs the Entrepreneurship Center at Ball State University. Created one of the great courses. The great course is actually a term for very highly curated courses called the Entrepreneur's Toolkit. And he is the author of a new book called Entrepreneurship. Catch this, the Disney way. All right, before we forget, we talked about financing. So let's say, great, let's say I have no money. I want to start my kombucha business, and it doesn't require a lot of money, but it's going to require some. Probably need to at least, you know, pay some rent to a commissary kitchen or whatever to make to brew it up or whatever. And I might be able to do it in my kitchen, but with California laws, which are just for food, are just wildly expensive to, and tons of regulation, I probably need a commissary kitchen. So let's say I need $30,000, not some $2 million like a restaurant. But let's say I need 30 grand and I don't have any 30 grand. I maxed out my credit card at 7,000. How would I go about going and raising another 23 grand?
Well, to get that 23 grand, you're probably going to have to just take it a step further from the test that you did at your house with your friends. And you're just going to find those small venues that will give you a shot. And you'll probably be doing this, at a very small scale, until you start getting customers who are now starting to call for more of it. And that's what you don't want to get to. You kind of want to get to that big break that you get when you just keep hustling and you keep trying to get it out there. When somebody believes that you really are on the something, something that people out there really look for is that person that does keep hustling. I mean, I can tell you that. In the business community, when somebody sees an aspiring entrepreneur who's got that grit and then has, with that grit, a great story, because I can tell you that oftentimes you're not only selling that product, you're also selling a great story. You know, those stories of hustle, you know, like one group of students I heard about from Calgary who actually hitchhiked from Calgary to Boston to go to a major trade show to show off their tech. That was a technology product, but they hitchhiked across the North America to get to that trade show. Stories like that of grit, and just taking it a step further as you go. You know, Marty, you and I have talked before, before the show, that I'm a fan of the long game. You know, I'm a fan of the long game, and part of that long game is just step by step by step, gradually scaling. And then later on, you can get those big scaling moments, those big moments of scale, when somebody throws a lot of money at you. But early on, it's just gradually building that market over time and being committed to it. And you may have to work a full-time job, in the meantime to pay your bills or to have your benefits.
I have a number of things I want to say about that. First of all, grit is all well and good, but I know a hell of a lot of people who have a lot of grit but don't have a lot of brains and don't have a lot of good idea, and they just try to get by with persistence. So grit is necessary but totally insufficient. So, you know, when I watch Shark Tank and I see these people who seem like airheads who, talk about, I'll give anything, I'll work 24 hours a day. That's fine, but it's not enough. It's only, to me, 20% of the equation. Second, in terms of getting big, I think it is one of business school's fatal flaws that they are always implying that the entrepreneur needs to get big. Scalable is the word they ever use. And in reality, what happens is the odds multiply enormously when you try to get too big, and ethically the quality goes down. It's very easy to keep your kombucha quality high when you've got a relatively constrained target area and a relatively small amount. Once you start to go big, the quality goes down, and that's when you're also more beholden to the banks and you're now borrowing money. So I'm not crazy about that. And the third thing I want to say is, if I were trying to go, as you said, one step beyond my living room, well, the way I would take it, the next step is I would identify a half a dozen likely local, easy to serve customers nearest to my commissary kitchen, and I would pitch them, and I would do my best to serve them really well, and then hopefully when I got reorders, that would be the proof that I would give to the bank. I wouldn't have to show that I drove across country or anything else. I wouldn't even have to drive across town. I would find five venues close to me, and if I said three out of the five reordered and increased their order, that's all I need. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. That'll work. Yeah, and that's making that circle, those steps a little bit further. You know, something else too is once you've gotten that proof of that you've got customers willing to buy from you and willing to repeat buy, you can also start. Then you're able to start working deals not only with the bank but also with suppliers and other people that you need to make this business work. I mean, they're hoping that you'll be turned into a long-time customer for them as well.
Right. Okay, let's move on. So let's say, you know, one of my core beliefs is that it's wiser to replicate than to innovate. You know, the leading edge too often is the bleeding edge. Guinea pigs turn out to be, you know, guinea pigs die. So there's plenty of money that's made at lower risk by replicating. But other than some vague urging me to do what you love, which is what in the Bay Area is what everybody says, but what most people love one of just a few things. We love the environment. We love you know, ethnic food. We love sports. We love, you know, a certain small number of things. So let's say it's very expensive to live here in the Bay Area. I don't have the luxury of wanting to compete with 9 zillion people. So I'm willing to go be in the widget business. It could be, nuts and bolts. It could be whatever it is. It is has no sex appeal at all, but it's still ethical. If I told you that, you're my advisor, you're my consultant, and I said, I don't care what the hell it is. It can be scrap metal, industrial acids. I don't care. But in the year 2019, moving to 2020, as long as I want to, and I'm not trying to get rich, I want to make $100,000 a year ethically without working 90 hours a week and with relatively low risk. What advice would Mike Goldsmith give me?
I would give you two pieces of advice. I'll give you three pieces of advice. One is to really, really, really pay attention to detail. I mean, just really be that person that tries to deliver the best service possible. Because I can tell you that today we live in a distracted world. As much as the e-commerce and social media and all that helps you with marketing and other data analytics and things like that, for the average business, really being disciplined about making sure your customer's happy and going that and surprising them with good service.
I'm going to interrupt you. Those are good, just basic business. I'm talking about specific. My listeners here who are listening to my show are now at this point where they're saying they're willing to sell a widget. What widgets would Mike Goldsby specifically investigate that is not sexy, that's under the radar, but promise an ethical way to make a middle-class living? If I put a gun to your head and I said, Mike, what three things would you investigate that are not sexy, that are widgets, if you will, or services that are widgety services, what would Mike Goldsby investigate?
Well, the first one I would really investigate would be home repairs.
Okay, keep talking.
Yeah. The second one would be something along family services or child care or something that would help busy families out. And the third one would probably be something around pet care of some sort. Those are things that so many people out there all need, and it's hard to find really good services in that.
All right, now I'm going to be tough. It seems that child care is very subject to regulation. You can do it in your house, but you're not going to make enough money because in your house you can have, what, 4, 6, 8 kids? There's no money there. Pets, there's a pet sitter and a pet walker under every rock here in the Bay Area. I don't see that leading to $100,000 at all. I think that home repair, yes. If you have that skill, I could see that. And I like micro niches. So the niche I like within home repair would be senior retrofitting. As the boomers are aging, they're more likely to need ramps, even stair elevators. They're more likely to have, you know, bathtubs that are walk-in or have assist handles. That's what I would do. If you were my professor, would you say, Marty, that's a bad idea? What letter grade would you give me, A, B, C, D, or F?
Oh, on the senior retrofitting of homes, I give you an A on that.
Okay.
I mean, that has it all. That's the... You've got the demographics. You've got the people that have the money to do it. You've got a way that if you are doing it well, word of mouth and trust is a real good opportunity there. I mean, that would be a winner, I would think.
All right, now let me flesh that out then. So if I were trying to get the business, here's what I would do. I would probably develop relationships with I would give talks at adult centers. There are adult day centers where adults go who are in assisted living. They're still independent, but they live in condos or whatever in adult communities or retirement communities where they own their own place, so they're responsible for their own maintenance. No, I wouldn't do that because that's already going to be covered if they're senior housing. But there are these places that are to serve the community where the adults go during the day to dance or arts and crafts or whatever. And I would go there and I would give talks on the five keys to making, to being safe. Safety is a hot button issue for older people, especially. Five keys to making your home safe. And I would do that also at Rotary Clubs, Kiwanis, because those people, those tend to get older. I would do it at churches. Older people tend to go to churches. And that would be how I would market. And I might also develop a relationship with architects, residential architects. People, only people who can afford architects are older, because it's expensive to build a house with an architect. And I would try to develop relationships with architects where they sub out the that work to me, and that's what I think. What do you think of that?
Oh yeah, those are all great, definitely. And you know, as you talk to all those people, you're going to get the ideas that actually end up building that business. I mean, I'm a big fan of really going out there and gathering information from all these experts, all these people that are knowledgeable in the business you're trying to get into, and it will start to take shape.
How are you going to get them to talk to you? That's the problem. Let's say I was going to do that. I wanted to do senior retrofitting, so I phoned some guy in Indianapolis, because I'm here in the Bay Area, and I'm not worried about the Indianapolis guy competing with me. How likely, you know, I have so many of my clients frustrated when they try to do, quote, informational interviews, and everybody is so hit up, you know, anybody who's good is so busy and hit up with informational interview requests that unless, you know, I'm sleeping with his daughter, I'm not going to get a call back. What, any tips on how to get that inside information that you correctly point out is critical. If I'm going to start that senior retrofitting business and I'll call people in Cheyenne, Wyoming and in New York City, any tips on how to maximize the chance of getting a call back?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you want to think about where these people are, for one thing. So, you know, trade shows, trade organizations can be very handy.
Good.
We actually do a lot of work with the North American Retail Hardware Association, which is an amazing industry. They're all over, you know, hardware stores everywhere. Mm. And this organization will give you everything you need to know about the cost of a business, startup, details. So there are trade groups that want to see more people go into these industries.
Well, you know, a little side question. You know, there's a term called rationalize. Hardware is one of those industries that's been rationalized. It started out as mom and pops, then it became Ace Hardware, and then, of course, it's Lowe's and Home Depot. So I would be avoiding any business that was already rationalized. The last thing in the world I'd want to do is open a hardware store. I don't care whether the industry wants me to join it or not. But what I would be more likely to start as a business that's a little less simple, but would be to rationalize an industry that is not currently very rationalized. An industry that does consist mainly of mom and pops. I've noticed they did it with veterinarians. They created Veterinary Corporation of America, where they go to an individual veterinarian and say, I will do your marketing for you. I will help you figure out how to run your business more efficiently. You're a great veterinarian, but you're not necessarily a great business person. And they buy up a bunch of, or they develop a partnership relationship with a bunch of veterinarians. So I would find an industry like that, whether it be psychotherapists or it be audiologists or whatever, and I would try to, if I was marketing oriented, I would try to get them to come under my umbrella, and that's how I would make my money. What do you think of that idea?
That one is a pretty neat idea. That one might be a little bit harder, right? Because you're dealing with experts, and they're probably pretty proud of their practices. They're probably only going to move along if it becomes only in their survival benefit to do it, which, you know, happened a lot in a lot of practices in medicine where it really, the economics got to a point where they just, a lot of these doctors had no choice but to join those types of groups.
The way I pitch it, though, is I would say it's still going to be called Dr. Joe Jones, Doctor of Veterinary Medicine. I'm not going to change your name. I'm going to help you do what let you do what you do best, which is be a vet. So that his ego and his branding doesn't really change. There might be a small little sign there. This is a, you know, veterinary, I mean, a audiologist of America, practice. But he would still be able to, I would make sure that, everybody who's a successful person tends to have an ego and feels he or she is great. So I would make sure that in my pitch I would preserve that.
That's smart. That's smart. If you're going to try that, that's what you need to do. Well, it all comes down to cost benefits, right? So if you can show it's in their best interest to join you in doing that, and you make a good case for that, and you've got other examples where that has worked, as you said, in other industries where or other types of practices where people have benefited from that type of thing, and you want to move in and do that for them, run, and you can sh- show the numbers and show why they'll make more, and you might have a good shot at that.
I would say cost benefit is one of the factors. People are emotional about their businesses. It's not just a transaction like I'm going to buy the cheapest commodity. So I need to appeal to their emotional needs too. You know, do they want to help more sick animals? What's their hot button? Do they want more free time with their family? So I'd be having this conversation with them to understand what their emotional hot button beyond cost effectiveness is, so I have a better chance of closing the deal, it seems to me.
Well, exactly, yeah. And that comes again from those conversations, right? And you'll probably start to find that there, as you have more of these conversations with people, like those different audiologists, you'll probably start to see some themes that really, really perk up. And I'm a big fan of really, as you said, Marty, you know, that emotional side, listening to those, what I call the subtle tells or the reveals, mm-hmm. that really tell you that you've hit that real hot button with that person. And, you know, when their eyes light up, you want to take note of that, because that's something that you can really start to build more of that business around.
Dear listeners, that's relevant to everything, not just in buying businesses or dealing with customers. It's relevant in romance. It's relevant with your coworker in the break room, with your boss. You know, we all think we're good listeners. We're crappy listeners. We barely hear what somebody's saying. We're so interested in jumping ahead to the brilliant pearls that we're about to spew. And we certainly don't look beneath the surface. What is the emotion that is underneath what is said and not said? That is not easy, but it ends up being the critical difference between successful people and unsuccessful people of equal IQ. I'm going to give out the phone number. If you've been listening to this, I've been talking with Mike Goldsby. He runs the Entrepreneurship Center at Ball State University, and he is the author of a new book called Entrepreneurship the Disney Way. If you have a question for him and me, I like to do on this radio show, we don't do really interviews, we do conversations. So if you have a question for Mike or me about starting your business, or your business is struggling and want us to draw it a lifeline, the phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Mike, have you ever run a business yourself?
Well, I've been involved in three ways of running a business. I when I got out of college, I actually was a production line foreman for a furniture factory, which gave me a lot of experience managing people and meeting a bottom line and getting things in the box and on the truck. But also had a great experience before I got my doctorate. I helped my uncle design, build, and run a family golf course that the family had for 20 years. Yeah, and we did it all from bootstrapping. We did it. We had a cow pasture. We had a Field of Dreams moment. You know, build it and they will come. Mm-hmm. And we bought a backhoe, a dump truck, and a bulldozer. And we got a PGA manual on how to build golf courses. And we built that thing from cash and sweat equity.
What's a lesson that you learned from doing that you have either passed along to your students or you want to pass along to my listeners?
Sure. There were two things. We built that golf course for our particular market. So it was, you know, we did it right before Tiger Woods got on the scene. This was back in the 90s when we started it. And then Tiger came on the scene. It was good timing. We were there at the right time and things really took off. But there were a lot of golf courses that came and went during that same period of time. And what we did was we knew that we were in a blue-collar area and there weren't a lot of pro golfers in our area. So we actually mowed the fairways really wide. We made the roughs really short. Mm-hmm. There was very little chance you were going to lose your ball. It was a beautiful setting, mm-hmm. but it was also not particularly hard, but we put a few holes that were hard for good golfers that they were challenged a little bit. But we were playing to our market, and as a result, we were packed. We had good business.
Wow.
So that was one thing.
Yeah.
We designed to our market. But the second thing was we built additions to the course every year as we made more money. So we put the money back into the business. We called them projects. And it wasn't until 6 years later when we built the second nine holes when we had enough money.
Right.
And as a result, we were always profitable and we were always in the black.
Well, sounds great. I want to ask you one more softball question before I let you go. If there was one more thing that you wanted to tell our listeners that maybe is not so obvious, that is crucial to succeeding in a one- or two-person business if you don't have a lot of money and you're not some data scientist super person, you're just a normal person, what's one other tip you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think you have to become a maniac about personal productivity and time management. I mean, you have to be a real student of that, because there are actually approaches out there that work very well. And if you don't have it together, if you're not on top of your time and really focused and disciplined, you're not going to be able to give good service to your customers. Things are going to be a mess. People sense that. People want to feel that they're trusting you with your business, and I think it starts with you. You've got to really get things under control.
I couldn't agree. You know, when you're working for an organization, you've got a lot of supports for you. You've got IT, you've got accounting, you've got a boss breathing down your neck, you've got structures, you've got processes, you've got everything. When you're a one or a few person business, it's all on you. You not only have to not be a procrastinator, but you have to be good at figuring out how to get the most done in the least amount of time. And you have to have this core sense of responsibility. You don't need to be frenetic. You don't need to rush. But you need to have this core sense of this responsibility to yourself, to your family, to the business, and that takes precedence. And that, unfortunately, for better or worse, to compete in a normal market requires you to put in, certainly in the first years, a lot of hours to get it all done right. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, sir. I agree 100%.
Okay. So, Mike Goolsbee, thanks very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco. The book, yet again, is Entrepreneurship, the Disney. Tell me one thing about the book that we haven't talked about. What's Entrepreneurship, the Disney Way?
Yeah, so the Disney Way is that being an entrepreneurship professor and also specializing in creativity, I've always felt that Walt Disney and the company after Walt was the best example of combining creativity and business together. And it's a rare company where the founder entrepreneur has a company that lived on well beyond him and actually is bigger than ever. That's really rare in business history.
Yeah. What's one practical tip that we haven't said that, you know, a book has got a lot of stuff in it. What's something, I mean, I'm not asking, I'm expecting my listeners to open the next Disney World, but what's one tip that the Disney Corporation, whether it be Michael Eisner or Walt Disney himself or whatever, did that would be applicable to regular people who are starting or running their own business?
Well, I think it's always be willing to move to where your best opportunity is. And that's what the company still does. And when you do that, back it up with quality. I think that's something that's been lost in this country, I think, is that people don't really move to their opportunities as much as they used to.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to have had our conversation here on Work with Marty Nemco. Mike, take care. I wish you the best.
Thanks, Marty. I really appreciate being on your show.
Good. Be well.
Thanks.
Okay, now we turn to you, my dear listeners. A core purpose of this show is to focus on you. We do what are called workovers. That's the royal we. I do workovers. If you have a work problem or someone you care about has a work problem, either because you are unemployed or well-employed and still unhappy, whether you are self-employed, work for the government, work for a small company, large company, the only operative word is that you're sad or angry or scared or something, you got a problem related to work life. Frankly, the harder the better, because I've been doing this almost 30 years. I've heard it all. So if you have a work-related problem, I call in for, this is the time to call when the lines are available, for what I call a workover with no pummeling involved, usually. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. There is a young man I know who is finishing his senior year in high school, and he's got a 1.5 GPA. He has what his mother calls learning differences. That's the current term, learning differences, including another jargony term of the day, poor executive functioning, and he's doing a lot of drugs. And his mother has decided to send him to a wilderness residential school for kids who abuse drugs. The mother said, well, I think it'll better prepare him for college. Jeez. With a 1.5 GPA in high school and big-time drug problems, she's thinking part of the problem may be these unrealistic expectations. In any case, this school, I asked her about it, while it's not a military academy, it has like near-military strict rules, like no social media, your bedroom has to be exactly perfectly clean, and no cursing is allowed. I'd get punished every day. Anyway, the kid, not surprisingly, he's 17. He's resisting going. He says, This is what his mother said to me. You're abandoning me so you can just have fun. You just wait till I'm 18. I'm going to bust out of there and you'll never see me again. Those programs, as well as adult residential drug programs, have a quite high relapse rate. And I think that's understandable. Most kids wouldn't want to go to such an academy. And so they've got an interest in the program not working. They would tell them, see, I told you it wouldn't work. Also, putting a bunch of kids who all have drug problems together 24/7 seems to me like a formula for their bonding together to fight against the rules. They'd scheme to get away with as much as they could. And then when they graduate, I guess you graduate from even those places, a lot of them could feel like they were freed from their jail and they'd go back to their own ways, maybe even with a vengeance. If I were the parent, I would not send my kid to an academy. This is what I would do. First, I would try to find him legitimate basis for hope. Kids do drugs a lot when they go beyond the experimental phase because they're just curious, because they feel they don't have a lot of hope. They have nothing, not much to lose by doing a lot of drugs. Well, if he's got a 1.5 GPA in high school, and that's significantly a function not just of the drugs because he's of his, quote, learning differences, his lack of executive functioning, it's pretty unlikely that college, which is harder, is going to be a path to his career success or even academic success. So I would help my kid identify some career that interested him that didn't require college. Maybe a robot technician or a medical equipment technician or electric car mechanic, something like that. And we would find videos on the internet on careers like that. And if he was still interested after watching the videos, I would try to dig up. And I wouldn't expect him to do it himself. He's not that motivated at this point. I got to do, even though I wish he was self-motivated, I would probably have to take the lead on this. I would try to find some workplaces where people who are doing that career. And ideally, when we're there, the person would try to teach him something basic about that career. And if he could learn it, that would give him a bit of evidence that he actually had some hope of becoming expert at something. I would then find the best local training program, local because I want him living at home. This kid can't live away. He needs structure. And maybe probably a community college because, you know, that's the best deal in town. And if I needed to, having saved the money by sending him to a community college, if the kid was learning slowly because of his learning disability, I would hire a tutor to help him. I would have my kid live at home because he needs structure and supervision. And I would impose moderately restrictive rules. But I would agree that the rules, I'd relax them or tighten them depending on how well he did. And I would also absolutely set up random drug tests. And I'd relax the rules if he passed and tighten them if he failed. You know, that kid needs structure. He's not just going to be motivated by talking about the dangers of drugs or that it's not going to help him in the long run. I would explain to him that I was setting up these rules not because I'm rigid, but because we all make progress with baby steps. But I wouldn't just rely on rewards and punishments. I would occasionally, yes, I would remind him that staying clean and sober and working toward becoming expert at some career is going to enable him to make money and buy whatever it is he wants, car, take a girl out for a date, whatever. And he will then, if he's got some money and he's got a career, he's going to be better able to attract a quality romantic partner who's going to bring out the best in him, not drag him down further, which I have seen in many cases where some druggy guy, desperately lonely, find some other druggy woman because that's the only kind of woman that would be attracted to him. And they get dragged, they drag each other down into even greater depths. And the final thing I want to say is, and I'm going to go to the phones in just a minute, I'd be aware that I am not just the saint who has to sacrifice everything. I'm entitled to a life too. If I have, after all those years of effort as a parent and all the cost, my kid was still making little progress, I'd say something like, I've given you 20 years, and I'm getting older myself. I'm entitled to a life. You are on a one-month last probation. If you're not significantly better, I'm kicking you out. And sometimes that nuclear option is that tough love, that wake-up call that the kid needs. But truthfully, sometimes even that, atop all those previous efforts, isn't going to help. So I would remind myself that, like all of us, we're at least half genetic. And so we all have to have the wisdom to know when the right time is to reclaim our life. Anyway, that's a kind of career problem that I don't often talk about on the show, but I wanted to share that with you. It just occurred yesterday when this mother and I were talking. Anyway, I'll give out the phone number and then I'm going to go right to the phones. If you've got a work-related problem of any sort, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hi, it's you.
Hi, am I live?
You are.
Hey, how's it going? How are you?
I am well. What gives me the honor of the call?
Good, thanks. So I am class of the great year of 2009.
Okay.
I studied finance.
Okay.
From a Jesuit university.
Yep.
And so I've been working in operations for a company in a financial role for about 7 years now.
When you say a financial role, that can mean many things. Are you doing setting up processes? Are you doing accounting related work? Are you raising money? Is you part of the fundraising operations? What are you actually doing?
Operations at a commercial real estate company.
Okay, and what does that mean? Are you dealing with the escrow? Tell me. I want a little bit more, so I have a better feel for what you do.
So office buildings.
Oh, you
okay.
So
on a day-to-day, I'm actually at the asset itself.
Okay, so you are not a project superintendent, but you are supervising the project superintendent in developing commercial office buildings. Is that correct?
Managing budget, dealing with design, construction, et cetera, leasing, all of it.
Great. Okay, continue.
So what I'm trying to do is switch into a more portfolio management type of role, right?
Real estate portfolio, in other words, a portfolio of various real estate holdings?
Correct.
Okay.
And making that transition has been extremely difficult because of the expectations that you either, one, are right out of school, or you have went to, a Princeton or a Harvard, et cetera.
Right. The answer to that normally is in proof that you've got the chops. My favorite trusty technique for making a transition when on paper you haven't proven that you could do it, and you can't get experience without the credentials, and you can't have you don't get the credentials without the experience, is to write what I call a white paper. So,
well, I've got it on paper. I've got my master's as well from a top tier university, but it's still I didn't get it from the top 10.
So let me finish. I'm not talking about that. I'm saying. To write as if pretend that I was your professor in that MBA program, a master in finance program, whatever, and I say to you, I need you to do a review of best practices in real estate portfolio management, and identify the top 5 to 10 important, not obvious principles for that portfolio management. And then synthesize that in a 3-page paper that is really current. I would then send that along with a compelling case for why you'd be so good to 20 target firms that could potentially, it's not going to be a designer label firm. You're not going to be working for Cushman and Wakefield. They are going to have their own people who have graduated from Princeton, Harvard, Yale, Stanford. But if you go to a second tier, you send to 20 second-tier firms that could use a portfolio manager, REITs, real estate investment trusts, or anybody that's got a portfolio of real estate, with that white paper, and you send to 20 and you follow up with phone calls, or even better, at their conferences, get on the conference program as a speaker, probably at a concurrent seminar, where you talk about the 7 new keys to portfolio management. That would get you to strut your stuff at these conferences. What do you think of those ideas?
That makes sense.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what you need to do next. Employers are wise to the fact that academic degrees are often longer on theory than practice. What I've given you is an assignment that's going to enable you to demonstrate that you know best current practices in the very specific kind of job you want, and to present it both in writing, as I said, but also in a session at a conference. And a lot of times these conferences are looking for fresh new ideas, and if you are able to synthesize the best of what's out there, you may well get to speak, at least if not at a national conference, even if it's just the regional chapter, you're likely to have to demonstrate your stuff in the same way as a would-be entrepreneur gets to strut his or her stuff at an angel investor meeting. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. I've got a gray hair or two, which is the other caveat. So when people want those fresh 23-year-olds, 10 years older.
You need that's nothing. You need to sell that as a plus. You know, that unlike these virgins who are, you know, who are long on theory that they got in their class and have no real-world experience, because you have been an operations guy in a office development firm, you know better than almost anybody all the devils that are in the details, and that's going to make you a hell of a better portfolio manager than Mr. or Ms. Snotnose.
Sure.
Got it?
Yep.
Am I overselling this, or does this feel right?
No, I think that it's what you're. I think it's another kick in the pants, because I've had a couple of those. So I think it's just a matter of doing it and building the gumption and making a compelling argument and getting in front of the right people, because sometimes people aren't listening. They already have a preconceived notion of this person, right? And that this is the mentality of that type of person that is trying to apply to that role, whereas. You know, I may have a different framework and the framework that they're actually looking for, but it's the compelling argument is the white paper, et cetera.
And the talk. Now, again, gumption is not required. What's required is a sense of zen. You don't have to get that job. You merely have to do your homework so that you're prepared to make the best, to share the best information you can with generosity. And generosity of spirit. You don't need to be a hyperactive motivational speaker. You need to, in your quiet way, you need to just present what you know in writing and at this talk, and let that, and then if it wasn't meant to be, it wasn't meant to be. It's that you don't need a lot of gumption. I'm not asking you to turn to a sales guy. I'm asking you, in consistent with your personality, I'm asking you to do your homework, to identify best practices, and then promulgate that in writing with the white paper and at a local regional conference. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay, thanks for calling Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you.
Go back to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hey, Marty. Thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure.
I talked to you, several years ago. I was starting a business, and that business has been started. It's been going strong for, I don't know, quit my day job maybe 9 or 10 years ago.
Great.
It was good. I actually got a short write up in Entrepreneur Magazine and written up in Fast Company. Sort of invented and manufacture sort of an innovative product. It's men's wedding rings, and they have a latch on them. I don't know if you remember any of our correspondence a while ago.
It's great. So, you know, it would be perfect for renewable marriages. You know, those new, you know, 1 year or 5 year, you can just, you know, open the latch and, you know, you can toss it away, when you reach the end of it. I'm making a little joke. Anyway, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, well, the idea is it makes for a ring that you can get a very nice size ring, and it's easy to take on and off for washing your hands, not so you can go be slutty or anything like that. Anyhow, I got recognized for, you know, identifying a market that was underserved, which is men's wedding ring.
Right.
You know, women have all kinds of cool rings to choose from, and men did not. And so the reason I'm calling is things have, you know, they took off and then had like a slow decline, and right now I'm like in a rough spot.
Okay.
And I'm trying to innovate my way out, you know, come up with fresh, you know, changes on that and some new products and such, but the market has changed in a couple like distinct ways. One is I've got competitors now. There's other people that they don't make rings that are like mine, that open, but there are some all kinds of interesting men's rings now with cool designs and such. And also the free press that I used to get for making something new and different is much harder to come by. Now you're like expected to pay influencers for them to, you know, mention you. So I'm working with someone who's helping with my social media. I'm working on my Instagram feed to like try, and my following is slowly building, you know, and trying to, you know, stay interesting and fresh there. But it's slow, and you know it's. And I've
okay, I'm going to interrupt you. I got it. Okay, I'm going to give you a buffet of options. You tell me if any of these you may have already done them or they sound good. Certainly, the LGBT market, LGBT thing is growing. You know, LGBTQIA. You know, the alphabet is getting longer. Have you created rings specifically aimed at the tastes that LGBT people have?
I was actually in a great jewelry store in the Castro, and they weren't very good at selling my products. It didn't have the appeal I kind of was hoping for. So I kind of have explored that market, you know. I mean, you know, maybe not to overgeneralize, but it's kind of like a guy's guy kind of product, and the, you know, but not necessarily that way.
I'm hearing two warning signs. I'm hearing one, because you're saying that just because that one sales guy didn't do well doesn't mean squat. And number two, it sounds like you were trying to sell your already prepared rings into that market. I would design, you know, I wouldn't go wild and spend a lot of money, but I would do, I would try to talk to some gay guys and show them 10 designs. Invite them to your house, or just go to a community room or whatever, and say which young, you know, marriageable age people, and try to get some, show them designs that would seem to have, you know, appeal to gay sensibilities, and don't make, you know, a massive number of them, but after that focus group, then try, say, three jewelry stores in a gay area. As a way, would that, because that could theoretically open your market up widely, because that really is a dramatic, you know, gay marriage is dramatically growing. What do you think?
I don't see any problem with that.
Okay. And the other thing I would probably do would be, I'm thinking, let's see, I want to give you one more. Oh, I'm looking at the clock. I don't have time. So what I would do, by the way, to do that would be, I wouldn't necessarily rely on my friends. There are all kinds of gay community centers, and I would go there with my little 10 drawings and just accumulate, make my target goal to have, you know, 50 people. And when I got a sense that which one, two, or three designs were best, I would, you know, whatever the relatively cheap casting method, lost wax or whatever is a relatively cheap casting method, to make a small quantity, that's what I would do. And then I would not rely on one dealer. I would find three, and I'd go on Yelp, and I would look at who in the gay area, in gay, you know, places where high concentration of gay, you know, like the Temescal area of Oakland or the Castro, who are the jewelers that have the best reputations with men, and I would make those my target customers. And that's my best advice, because I see the show is over. I wish you the best of luck with that.
I appreciate your help again, Marty. Thank you very much.
It is my pleasure indeed. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, the engineer, Phil Hartman, the man who's been around for a long time, who's always been a smiling, competent face here at KELW. And, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Thursday at 7. You can call in for a workover, plus the art of gaining more control of your time and conquering procrastination. Until then, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.